This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Connect Transit is doing better than many other bus systems.
The reason why we are outperforming our peer and regional agencies is because of the route restructure that took place in 2016 with more frequent service and on-time service.
Connect Transit manager Isaac Thorne says gas prices have a lot to do with recent ridership trends, too. Efforts are underway in Bloomington Normal to maximize the upcoming census count. Mary Cullen has an episode of McHistory dealing with Bloomington Normal favorite son presidential candidate Adlai Stevenson, and the mayor of Normal stops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal has maintained a AAA credit rating for a long time, unlike many. That came up as end-of-year budget adjustments came to the council last night. The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Chris Coos of Normal, welcome.
Oh, good to be here.
And so, are there challenges that would indicate that AAA credit rating is tenuous or at risk, or is it steady, smooth sailing?
Well, I'd like to say
a little of both, and that's kind of ambiguous, I understand. There are times in the recent past we thought, well, because of the state of the economy in Illinois and some other reasons, we're going to lose that rating. But Fitch continues to give us that rating, which we're happy about. They cite in that rating that they like the fact that there's a strong council culture and there's a strong management culture within the town of Normal. That's a factor that they cite as one of the reasons they're giving us that rating. You know, municipal economies throughout the United States are tenuous right now. Some cities are in really bad shape. Some are not so bad shape. And it's hard to predict in today's world where your revenues are going to come from. So we try to be very, very cautious and conservative in our budgeting to allow for that. This year, our revenues came in higher than we thought, which was a nice bonus. And it allowed us to replenish some reserve funds that we'd drawn down on in past years.
How healthy is the town's debt load?
I think it's quite healthy. There are numbers out there that say X percentage of your budget is a limit, and if you use those numbers, we're not there yet. The fact that we have identified, when we go to bonded debt, we have identified a revenue source or a funding source to cover that debt before we take that debt load on. For instance, Uptown Bonds, we budget 125% of the annual bond payment to make sure we have plenty of money to cover our debt and the sources of those that were identified years ago when we took on that debt.
How is the history of that revenue? Have you ever had to dip into that extra 25%, or have revenues pretty much matched obligations at the 100% mark?
We have been able to match our obligation every year, but we feel that that's an appropriate thing to budget for in case we have an off year, that we do have the money to cover our bonded debt.
So what do you do with the cushion at the end of each year?
The cushion would go back to the general fund. It could go into reserve funds. You know, we our goal is to have 15% of our general fund budget in reserve for lean years, and we dropped that down to about 12% during some tough years. We also drew down our vehicle reserve fund, and so the dollars that we see as a bonus this year are going back to replenish those funds.
The multifamily recycling ordinance that the town approved last summer goes into effect August 1st. It requires landlords to offer recycling to their tenants by that date. That's going to impact a lot of student apartments as well as more traditional residents. How is implementation going? What are you hearing?
You know, that's a good question, and you caught me off guard on that one. I'm not hearing anything, but I know staff is involved on that. And the way that is structured is we really want to be able to work with the multifamily property owners to make sure this works for everybody.
This thing passed the council last summer. It gave landlords a full year to get on board and have a plan in place. Did that work? Enough lead time?
Well, we'll see. I mean, that goes into effect in August, so we'll see how ready that they are.
Are you concerned about rents going up as a result of this?
Shouldn't be that much. You know, the cost of recycling per tenant is going to be pretty low. I can't imagine that the rents will go up.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. You recently attended the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the Climate Mayor Action Summit. Let's talk about the U.S. Conference of Mayors first. That always results in a nice sharing of ideas about what other municipalities are doing. What did you come back with that might be portable to Bloomington Normal?
Well, I think in the situation that raised the most concern was in Transportation and Communications Subcommittee, which I'm a member of, as is Mayor Renner. And so issues of improving transit throughout the United States, fully funding the Highway Trust Fund for road repair and infrastructure in the United States were issues. In the communications side, probably most important was what we're calling small cell 5G rollout in communities. And small cell rollout requires a lot of repeating stations, if you will. Or that's probably not the right term.
Does that clutter the landscape?
That's our concern. That's a lot of concerns that mayors have. And we would like local control over how that's rolled out in our communities. It's a big issue for mayors. The telecoms are fighting that at the federal level. They want federal control only and no control in terms of local.
Well, it would be tidier for them. It makes it easier for them to cite things rather than going through the municipality. But what's the potential impact on livability and the appearance of a community?
I think the appearance issue, I mean, we've seen pictures of 5G, or I should say small cell. 5G is not necessarily small cell. Small cell rollout where things are hung on telephone poles, wires going everywhere, and by the fact that they have to be every 30 yards or so throughout the community to work, it's a web network, it can be pretty unsightly. And, you know, people will be very upset by that. And so we want the ability to have some local control over that.
How is this different than what people used to do with having ham radio or TV antenna towers in the back of their yards, or when cell phone towers first came into play? That was considered unsightly at the time, and there were before people got used to them, it really was an issue.
Well, there were regulations on TV towers and TV apparatus. I do know that. And there weren't that many ham radio towers. These would be everywhere in the community because it has to work as a web network to function well. So they'd be on every street, every 30 yards or so.
Has it reached Congress?
It's not reached Congress in an actionable way. It's being discussed in committee, and there's a lot of lobbying going on for sure.
Or does it come as a rulemaking out of agencies first and then to Congress? What's the process?
I think watching how the lobbying system works, they're probably working both sides of it simultaneously.
So how should cities address this then? Because there are of course lobbyists for big groups like the U.S. Conference of Mayors, but they don't have the pockets that the telecoms do.
Well, we're hopeful that, you know, we represent the mayors of the United States, represent about 80% of the population of the United States, and we hope that we can get some leverage on that. And we know we're going to be the first to hear about it if it goes wrong. You know, it's not as bad, but we lost the battle on fiber installation. And if you've noticed recently around the community, there's almost always fiber being installed in the same rights of way, and telecoms have the right to do that. You could go up and down Vernon Avenue, and there's probably 6 or 7 fiber lines going through there now. You could have 20 in there, and we don't have any say on that.
Is there a parallel, a straight line parallel to between fiber and this above ground 5G?
Well, only in the sense, you know, they're improving communications in the community and broadband accessibility, but cable is only unsightly while they're installing it, where small cell is going to be there every day.
The small cell networks, when can we expect that to work their way down to mid-sized cities like Bloomington and Normal?
Well,
obviously, the telecoms are going to want to do the major metro areas first.
Exactly. And there's not much being done at this point, and that's why mayors are being proactive. You know, the people leading the charge are the mayors of Austin, Los Angeles, Atlanta.
Are we talking 5 years, 10 years out?
No, I couldn't answer that.
Okay. What about microtransit? That's another. You're also on the transit committee of the U.S. Conference of Mayors.
Yeah, the committee is transportation and communications. So, they don't ask me how the two got put together, but they did.
Okay. So, what's happening on microtransit?
Oh, microtransit is just an effort to kind of fine tune a transit system, and one way they want to do that is have better access to private haulers like Lyft and Uber. And that for small trips and that. But current regulation governs how transit dollars can be spent on that. And it's very cumbersome, if it can be done at all, that you can spend transit dollars to support those kind of niche transit operations within a system.
So there might be a public sector microtransit option in the future?
That's something some of the larger cities want. And if you look at the recent Connect Transit conversation, that's something that that might be beneficial to this community.
So for those with mobility challenges?
I think that's probably the first touching point, which gets into the issue then, does your Uber driver or your Lyft driver have an accessible vehicle?
This cuts against the free market system, which is where people are now on taxis and Uber and Lyft. Is there a moderating influence to have a public sector presence in that space?
You know, I think I know what you're asking there.
And price competitiveness is where I'm going with that.
I think it's more in a microtransit world, and it's going to depend on the municipality and what kind of rules that they can get if the federal government relaxes the funding rules. And so my sense of it is that it would be a public agency dealing with the private market.
And how far away will that question be resolved?
It's up to the federal government to answer that one.
Okay. You also attended the Climate Mayor Action Summit. What are mayors interested in regarding global climate change?
There's about 426 at last count mayors that have signed up to be what they call a climate mayor and involved in climate issues. And the overarching principle of it, this had happened once before in the late 90s, that mayors have decided if the federal government is not interested in honoring Paris climate accords, that cities would do the best that they could do to honor that.
And how are they piecemealing the programs and initiatives to get their municipalities on board with that?
I think it varies community to community. You have cities in Florida that are dealing with rising seawater and how they're going to protect their communities in that environment. You've got cities like Los Angeles where you've got gridlock on the highways and the cost of power is very expensive there. So a lot of the talk was around renewable energy usage, rollout of electric vehicles, and improved transit. Now, it depends on the city you're in and the size of your city you're in and what your transit system is like. I'm trying to think of a city that's got a big city that's got a transit system that's not struggling like the metro in D.C. or, you know, New York's going through a major rebuild of their system. But they're trying to get transit more accessible to people to relieve the congestion of single-occupancy vehicles.
And if they do that, are they also considering larger rollouts of electric? And how will they pay for that?
I'm not sure your question.
So another way to address the emissions issue for public transit is to go more electric for the buses. How are they paying for that?
Well, I think, you know, you get an economy of scale. The federal government is investing money in electric buses and doing grants. Connect Transit has a grant to get electric buses on the road. And we're in the infancy of that. You know, it's just now starting in terms of that because of battery technology primarily.
Are there local initiatives that mid-sized municipalities can or are considering to encourage solar installation or electric vehicle adoption?
There are. You know, a lot of the utilities, I know Ameren has programs to help people with solar installation, cover the cost of that. There's an emphasis on getting solar.
Is that a function that should be within municipalities too, though? Not should there be municipal incentives in addition to Ameren incentives?
We'd have to look at that. You know, I think getting our own house in order would be a priority over that. And it's something I've asked City Manager Pamela Reese to look at. Is there an ability to put solar on our parking decks in the greenfield by the power plant, the water plant? And can we generate enough solar power to power our water treatment plant and Uptown Station? I think Uptown Station we can do. Water treatment plants draw a lot of power, and the ability to reduce that cost and take it to renewable, I think, is something we need to explore.
Okay. A lot of the challenges to climate change, say, for example, in Florida, heavy rainfall events and rising sea levels will put put a crimp on how municipalities design their systems. Houston is another example where they had so much rainfall in such a tiny amount of time during a recent hurricane that it just swamped their systems. And they're in the middle of redesigning those systems for peak events. Is that something that Normal and Bloomington should be considering as well?
I think as we go forward, we don't, you know, we've had our share of it here. It's affected the agricultural community more than it has the two cities. But I think as we grow as a community, we have to take that into account in our new infrastructure systems. And as we upgrade systems, we need to be aware of that.
What other takeaways did you come with from the summit, the climate summit, and from the U.S. Mayor's Conference?
Well, I think, you know, the strongest takeaway is always the interaction you have with other mayors and talking about the situations they have, be they political or municipal issues that they're dealing with. And the strong fact that there are very definitely Republican mayors and Democratic mayors and Libertarian mayors and Independent mayors, all that gets parked at the door. We all have the same issues. And if you're Los Angeles, your issues aren't that much different from Bloomington Normal's issues in terms of running an effective municipality. The only difference is the number of commas and zeros after your budget.
Mayor Chris Koos is with the Town of Normal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Connect Transit General Manager Isaac Thorne. On the 4th of July weekend in 1956, one of Bloomington's most famous residents returned to rally support ahead of the presidential election. GLT's Mary Cullen produced this episode of McHistory, remembering Adlai Stevenson's call to his hometown.
Vote Stevenson, a man you can believe in, son.
This is a delicate and dangerous period in world affairs.
His leadership has won him fame. A soldier man is always bound to think in terms of battleground. But Stevenson, civilian son, will lead us till the peace is won.
Don Chandro, the executive artistic director of the Coalescence Theater Project.
This is Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History. What we're hearing here is Adlai Stevenson, who is visiting his hometown of Bloomington for 2 days over the July 4th weekend. He was the odds-on favorite at this time to capture his party's nomination for president, and Adlai Stevenson was a Democrat. So he was at Miller Park on Bloomington's west side at a picnic sponsored by the McLean County Democratic Central Committee and speaking on the issues of the day. And this is in the midst of the Cold War and our titanic struggle with the Soviet Union, among other major issues. Adlai Stevenson, probably arguably Bloomington's favorite son, most famous resident, or close to it certainly, wasn't born in Bloomington, but his family has deep roots here. He will come here with his family at the age of six and be raised in Bloomington. So this is truly his hometown. He comes from upper middle class circumstances, is raised on what was then the far east side of Bloomington on East Washington Street, attended Washington School, which is still there today, and then what was known as the Model School, or we know today as University High School.
It's Adlai to you, Adlai to me, I don't care how you quote it. Adlai, Adlai, don't pronounce it, just go out and vote it. Stevenson!
The economy was humming in 1956. Eisenhower could claim peace, or at least a truce, on the Korean Peninsula, ending the Korean War. One of the main issues in 1956, and Stevenson alludes to that during his visit here over the July 4th weekend, is Eisenhower's health. The war hero, the general, the commander, had a serious heart attack in 1955 during his first term. And then in June of 1956, we'll have an operation for an inflamed small intestine. And the issue there was that Eisenhower's vice president was Richard Nixon. And a lot of the public looked askance or looked with a little bit of weariness at Richard Nixon. There was obviously no love lost between Stevenson and Eisenhower, but Stevenson, I think it can be said, really despised Eisenhower. There was no love lost there. Stevenson famously said of Richard Nixon that he is the kind of politician who would cut down a redwood tree and then mount the stump and make a speech on conservation.
Nervous about Nixon? President Nixon? Vote Democratic, the party for you, not just the few.
The demand for bread and freedom by the oppressed peoples of Eastern Europe is irrepressible, and the rulers tremble. The tragedy is that at this hour, the Western nations lack leadership. The West is divided, hesitant, unsure. when we could and should be the calm and confident spokesman for free men everywhere.
So another huge issue during the 1956 campaign was the Cold War and the nuclear arms race with the what used to be the Soviet Union. Soviet-backed troops had just smashed the so-called Bread and Freedom Revolt, workers' revolt in a central city in Poland, and we hear Stevenson making a reference to that.
They do not know. No one knows how events will move. A little breath of freedom is a dangerous thing in a totalitarian regime. And the West must make it clear that the Soviet rulers cannot find any solution to their internal problems in external adventures. That is why the quality of Western leadership is so important now. I pray we may have the strength and vision to rise to our needs and opportunities.
Unfortunately for Stevenson, during the final days of the campaign, there's the Suez Canal crisis, where Israel, backed by Great Britain and France, takes control of the Egyptian Suez Canal. And then the Soviet Union, a few weeks before the election, will crush a drive for independence in Hungary. And even though both of those events reflect poorly on the Eisenhower administration, for most voters, they look toward Eisenhower as someone who can best suited to steer the ship of state, the United States, through turbulent waters. So Eisenhower, who was probably going to win the election anyways, these recent international events guarantee him a landslide. And on November 6th of 1956, Dwight D. Eisenhower will defeat Bloomington's Adlai Stevenson. Stevenson will only garner 42% of the popular vote, 3 points fewer than he had garnered 4 years earlier in the 1952 campaign. And Stevenson will only win 32% of the McLean County electorate. Today, McLean County is more of a purple county, but back then, historically, McLean County has been a Republican county. And the Stevenson family is actually 0-for-4 in national elections in McLean County.
The episode of McHistory was produced by GLT's Mary Cullen, featuring Bill Kemp of the McLean County Museum of History and Don Shandro of the Coalescence Theater Project.
We fight for identity, sometimes we kill for identity, but why is that?
I can't let my life be this, because if I give up right now, that's what my life will be.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for inspiring stories on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. CEFQ, not a bank, better. Details at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Connect Transit just recorded its third best year of ridership ever. The bus system in Bloomington Normal has had 13 straight months of increases in rides provided and a 9% increase plus in rides last year alone. Yet some in the community have been hammering Connect Transit for a price hike and route changes. As a matter of disclosure, Connect Transit Board Chair Mike McCurdy is also WGLT Program Director. Today, we talk with Connect Transit General Manager Isaac Thorne about why the discrepancy between the successful numbers and public sentiment.
I think it goes back to it's been 12 years since we talked about fare increases. And, you know, that's on me, that's on the board. That was a mistake that we made waiting 12 years, because the public at that point in time thinks that the fares are never going to increase. And so you have to at least look at those and increase them on a regular basis. It'd be much easier for us 12 years ago to say we should increase it a small amount every year or every few years instead of waiting 12 years without a fare increase.
Why? Well, there were three different managers of Connect Transit in that 12-year period.
Yep.
So Why the wait?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, you always want to make sure you're taking care of your customers. And, you know, we think we're doing a benefit, or we're giving a benefit to the customers by not increasing the fares, making them very, very affordable. However, Connect Transit's set up differently in terms of funding than other agencies around us, such as Peoria, Springfield, Champaign. They're all transit authorities. They have the ability to tax. They bring in more revenue, and Connect Transit doesn't have that ability. So I think, you know, looking back 12 years, a lot of those agencies didn't raise fares. If they did, it was only by, you know, 25 cents in that time period. And Connect really never looked at it really, really hard to determine whether or not we should increase the fares. But I think looking back, that was a mistake over the last 12 years that we, by not doing it, that was a mistake.
Over the last 12 years, how much has the buying power of the fare decreased?
You know, we've added, it'd be hard to determine around the spot, but we've added, obviously, frequency. That's frequency of service. Our headways have moved from 60-minute service down to 30, and some routes have all the way to down to 15-minute service. So we've given our customers, obviously, a bigger bang for their dollar. They're getting more service for that $1 fare than they were, you know, 3 years ago. And that is something, you know, they repeatedly asked for is frequency of service, Sunday service, which we added in 2016. And they want buses that are going to be on time, getting them to, you know, work, medical appointments, and shopping on time.
How has your on-time performance changed over the 3 to 5 year period?
So prior to the route restructure in August of 2016, before that we were running about 72% on-time performance. Our service was 72% on time. We're now up to like 93-94%. Year to date. So it's drastically improved, and that's something I think, again, customers have responded to since we made the changes.
What is the gold standard for on-time performance?
Typically, you want to be around 90% or better.
Okay.
Now, obviously, you're looking at agencies such as Chicago, New York, LA. Traffic congestion plays a big factor into that. And, you know, those agencies are moving to bus rapid transit with their dedicated bus lines. We don't necessarily have the traffic congestion here in Bloomington Normal. It, obviously, at times it is bad, but we've, like I said, greatly improved our on-time performance.
Right, but when does poor on-time performance actually degrade ridership because people can't depend on a service to get them where they need to go when they need to be there?
Yeah, I think we were there at 72% or less. I mean, you're in the 70%. You're constantly getting phone calls from passengers asking, where's the bus at? Because they can't get to where they're trying to get to on time. They're late for work. It's just at that point in time, they're finding other multiple or alternative forms of transportation, whether that be walking, biking, calling a taxi, or buying a car.
And the frequency of those calls now is?
It's dropped significantly. We used to have over 400 phone calls on a daily basis for our fixed route service. It's now under 200. So a lot of those phone calls of people asking, where's the bus at? I'm at the stop. I don't see it. Those aren't happening anymore because the buses are running on time.
And of that 200, how much is potential rider unfamiliarity with the route, and how much is actual, we're not on time, we're late?
It's more of I'm asking, they're calling to ask for directions on how do I get to this location. It's a new location I'm going to. What routes do I use from my home or wherever their destination is or starting point is? How do I get to this destination? And we're explaining that on how to use the rider's guide, and then also explaining that we have a tool on our website that they can type in their address and where they're going, and it's going to show them which bus they need to take at what time to get there.
Let me circle back and ask, how much inflation has eroded that fare over the past 12 years?
Well, typically inflation runs about 2%. So, you know, 2% over 12 years is 24%. So us going from $1 to $1.25 for a fare increase is right at where we should have been inflation-wise if it's running at a standard 2% inflation.
Okay. But the inflation is compounded, so it's probably
a
little bit more
than
that.
Yeah, probably much higher than that.
So with this proposed fare increase, you haven't actually made up the stagger.
Correct, we haven't.
Are you still going to do the fare increase?
So one of the things the boards wanted to see at our last board meeting was to look at delaying the fare increase until January 1st. And that is the reason why they want to look at that is because the working group has just started their first meeting last month. They're going to have their second one this Saturday. And, you know, they're looking at where are we at today, where we want to be in the future. And we want to give them time to look at Connect Transit, all the studies we've done over the last few years, get better familiarize ourselves with that before they have to make a decision right away on what should we do with fares. So the board's going to be deciding next Tuesday on whether or not they want to delay that fare increase until January 1st. So that's where we're at right now.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Isaac Thorne, the manager of Connect Transit, Bloomington Normal's bus system. So how does the rides that were delivered last fiscal year by Connect Transit at over 2.4 million rides compare with peer institutions and compared with someplace like CityLink and Peoria?
Yeah, so Connect Transit's up 9.2% year-to-date. Most of the regional and peer agencies year-to-date are down around 2%, and that has pretty much been the norm. Their ridership is decreasing since 2015 or 16. And Connect Transit's been able to buck that trend over the last 2 years with a small 1% increase last year and then 9.2% this year. And, you know, I say the reason why we are outperforming our peer and regional agencies is because of the route restructure that took place in 2016 with more frequent service and on-time service. We are better serving our customers today than we were then, and our customers are responding to that because we know that our customers are transit dependent. They don't have a car. They may not have a driver's license, and they need our services to spend money and earn money here locally.
So route restructuring taking effect, building ridership back up because it's more dependable and more understandable is the reason. But why are the other ones declining?
So, you know, we were ahead of the curve in doing a route restructure back in 2016. There had been a few agencies in the United States that had done that, Houston being one of those, that saw immediate impact from the route restructure and giving more frequency to their customers. Most agencies haven't done that, though, in the last few years. And, you know, I know that Peoria right now is looking at doing that. They're even going to possibly hire the same consultants we had in Nelson Nygaard to do that route restructure. So there is a trend of agencies more now doing a route restructure, looking at it, hiring consultants to do this because we're seeing positive effects. And, you know, a lot of people, too, because the gas prices have dropped tremendously from 2016 and 15 when they were, you know, $4 and above $3 a gallon. They took transit more then than they are now. They're back to either driving their cars or looking at alternative forms of transportation. Maybe that's Uber. Maybe that's Lyft. Maybe that's just biking to work.
See, when I looked at those numbers, I was thinking, well, did the 2016 rate restructuring come way too late? And is it showing disproportionate benefits because Bloomington Normal waited so long to restructure? Under the Pete Weber years, when he was director, there wasn't a lot of rate restructuring.
There wasn't. You know, in 2015, 14, 15, and 16, 14 and 15 more so, we saw large increases in ridership. And every transit agency in America saw those same increases. Again, going back to
high gas prices.
Leaving 2015, going to 2016, we lost 200,000 rides that year because the gas prices dropped. People are making an economic decision of, look, I can drive now. I couldn't before. It's too costly. The price of gasoline was. I'm going to use, you know, alternative forms of transportation such as taking the bus or riding a bike. And then, you know, that's when we decided we were probably a little late on doing that. I would agree. But when we did make that decision, we also saw a small decrease again in ridership, and then finally it bounced back. I think it does take time for people to understand the routes. It's a whole new system. They had the same route system here in Bloomington Normal for over 30 years. But in 2018, we saw a small increase. 2019, a 19.2% increase.
So what's the future of transit in general? I mean, if the trend is generally downward because of the fuel prices, is ridership largely dependent on fuel prices, or will these other less expensive modes of transportation, whether it's electric vehicles or electric-assist bicycles or whatever, continue to depress transit nationwide?
Well, I think, in my opinion, mass transit is always going to be in existence. I think we just have to – people are going to continue using that for a number of different reasons. Obviously, it's much cheaper than driving your vehicle. Also, in certain areas and across this country, traffic congestion is also an issue of getting to work. So you're going to take transit. But I think you're going to see more agencies looking at route restructuring, providing frequency of service, adding amenities such as bus shelters and those sort of things to increase ridership. And the agencies that are doing that, customers, citizens are responding to that by riding transit more.
With these technological uncertainties, though, is now the time to be planning for and betting on fixed facilities like a new transfer center, which you're contemplating?
Yep. Well, we know that with Uber and Lyft, people and customers are using it in 2014, 15, 16. It really, really took off. What we know now in all the studies that have been done is that typically now people are using those services, Lyft, Uber, shared rides, typically on the weekends, Thursday through Sunday, for social events. Not necessarily going to work every single day, Monday through Friday.
So rather than drinking and driving, they're
correct.
Using Uber.
Yep, that's absolutely correct. But those, shared ride rider, Uber, Lyft riders are also taking transit throughout the week. So there's a benefit for both Uber and Lyft and Connect Transit. We're all playing a part in this. In terms of, you were saying, what was your follow-up to that question?
The future of transit, it's gonna, what is it gonna be like?
Yep. So, in terms of the downtown transfer center, I think that people are always gonna use mass transit. It's gonna be no different here in Bloomington-Normal. And again, we are serving individuals that are transit dependent. They may not have a driver's license. They are making less than $24,000 a year. They're going to continue using our services, and as we've shown over the last year, they're going to use it more. So downtown transfer center is a vital piece in continuing the increases that we're having and seeing. Right now, later this week, we're going to have a cooling station in downtown Bloomington because of the heat index. We wouldn't need to do that if we had a downtown transfer center. In the winter, we're going to have a cooling station. We wouldn't need to do that if we had a downtown transfer center. And our ability to continue to increase ridership, making sure people can make their transfers, get to work, spend money locally, is building a downtown transfer center that's going to be big enough to fit all of our buses and give a place for people to sit and wait for their transfers, and giving them real-time information to track where their bus is at.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking transit with Connect Transit Manager Isaac Thorne. So the Olive Route is gone after much public outcry. The Pink Route is supposed to substitute for that in large part, and there was a test phase offshoot of the Pink Route to take in part of the Orlando project, the Orlando Avenue residences. Mm-hmm. How is that going?
It's going well. So, yeah, the Pink Route is basically serving West Orlando Avenue every half an hour. So it's actually providing more service to West Orlando Avenue. And what we're seeing so far is full buses when it's leaving Orlando Avenue and continuing on the rest of the route. When it's coming into downtown station, it's pretty full. So it's so far what we're seeing, it's working. What we're trying to figure out is it going to have enough time when ISU students come back to actually make transfers and continue being on time in terms of service?
Well, if on-time service for the Pink Route becomes questionable, what do you do about it? Because you've designed the Pink Route to take over load from the Olive Route.
Yep. So what we can do is instead of servicing that West Orlando Avenue every 30 minutes, we could go to once an hour. That's something that we know that would work. Would give the Pink more recovery time to ensure and make sure that it's going to be on time when it hits Uptown Station to make transfers.
So every other bus that goes by the pink route up and down Main Street would turn into Orlando.
Yeah, that's something we'd definitely have to look at if it's not going to make it to Uptown Station on time. Because it's very frustrating for a customer if they're on the bus, they make it to the transfer center, they want to transfer another bus right away. They can't do that now because the bus came in late and they have to wait 30 minutes for that bus to come back.
Has the elimination of the Olive route largely transferred the riders to the pink route? They're not quite apples to apples, but do you think that most riders on the Olive route have made the adjustment?
I think majority of, even before when we still had the Olive route, there were customers on Shelburne Avenue where the tan or the olive and the pink overlapped that were taking the pink because it had more frequency. It was getting to Uptown Station. It's every 30 minutes instead of every hour. I believe that majority of the customers, as of right now, probably living on West Orlando taking transit service are using the pink route. And they still have the option as well to use the yellow route, which serves the corner of Main and West Orlando every 15 minutes during the school year and every 30 minutes during the day.
There is a new large apartment complex going into the area near the what used to be the Starplex Theater. It's now a different name, but that theater complex. What are your plans for that?
So we are going to we already service that area right now off the pink route. We believe that once people move into those apartments, that bus stop's going to become busier once that happens. So it's going to put more strain on the pink route itself. However, it's going to increase ridership. I think the pink overall this year had about a 10% increase in ridership. It's probably going to continue increasing after those homes are completed.
When will it be beyond capacity or at full capacity?
So if it does become over capacity on the buses, what we could do is look at an additional frequency for the route on the pink route.
One every 15 minutes? What?
Every 15 minutes is basically what we could do by adding another bus. We're going to continue monitoring it. We don't know if that's going to happen or not, but we do believe that there's going to be some more ridership because of that development.
When did you become aware of that development, and how does Connect Transit enter the conversation about where projects like that in dense housing go in the community?
Yeah, so typically a development like that would come to the town first. The town would then share that with McLean County Regional Planning Commission. And then we, Connect Transit, we get those plans. And there's a series of questions that the developer needs to fill out, basically a questionnaire. You know, are you seeking transit service in terms of walkability, sidewalks? There's a number of different questions they have to go through before I believe Town of Normal will actually approve the project. So we were aware of it, I do believe, over a year ago and started having those conversations. And we made a change at that point in time because we know this development was coming, to have the pink route go up and serve McKnight Street.
So the working group, as a facilitated process, will have its next meeting on Saturday, as you've already said. What do you expect to come out of that 3 to 4 month process?
Yeah, so they're going to come out with a final recommendation. Again, the working group is going to be looking at where is Connect Transit at today? What kind of transit system do we want in this community going forward, you know, 5, 10, 15 years from now? And, you know, here's all the goals that the group comes up with, the working group. I want transit to do X. How are we going to fund that that goal? And how are we going to create the system that we want 15, 20 years ago? So it's going to be a pretty comprehensive recommendation that's going to go from the working group to the Connect Transit board. And then from there, obviously, it's also going to be a report's going to be given to the Town of Normal Council and the City of Bloomington Council.
And will that result in requests for taxation or requests for additional funding from the municipalities under the current structure or what?
So I am not sure what the final recommendation is going to look like. There could be a funding component, whether that's more additional funding that they're requesting from the town and city to contribute, or final recommendation for a referendum that Connect Transit should become a taxing authority. I'm not sure what that final recommendation is going to look like, but both those options, I'm sure, are going to be on the table.
You made the comment on our air last year that by 2024, or in that range, all of Connect Transit's capital money will have to be allocated to operating money because of a structural deficit that is happening. Will the working group address that structural deficit definitively?
Yes. So what the work group has is basically our budget and our budget projections going out from, you know, this next fiscal year, this current fiscal year 2020, all the way to fiscal year 2024, when we will essentially at that point in time be using all of our federal funding, like you said, on operations. So it's definitely something that the working group is going to discuss. I know they're also going to be discussing, you know, fares, where they stand currently today, and our plan going forward. Everything is on the table for this working group to talk about and make their final recommendation for.
Isaac Thorne is the general manager of Connect Transit in Bloomington Normal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and Mayor Chris Koos of Normal. Thanks to him for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.